Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this visit in New Canaan, Connecticut with 96-year-old Frank Gallo, who was the Grand Marshal of New Canaan's Veterans Day Parade a few years ago and who continues to give back to his community. In his basement, he has an immaculate wood shop that he stays pretty busy in. During the pandemic, he busted out his sewing machine and made over 700 masks for a retirement home nearby. But back in World War II, Frank was just a teenager, manning 60-millimeter mortars with the 78th Infantry Division's 310th Regiment.
We were with the riflemen. As far as where you slept, you slept on the ground or in the snow. Being it was so cold, if it was in snow, you dug out enough of a slit trench for two guys to lay down and hug each other for body heat. Because we didn't have the equipment and coats like the Germans had. You didn't have a change of underwear. If you went through water and you got soaked, you wore the same socks, same underwear, maybe for a month.
And I want to get some perspective on that. So, I mean, growing up in Connecticut, you know what winter conditions are like, right? You've dealt with plenty of snow. You talked about your love of ice skating. But how much colder was it there in the Hurkin Forest and in the Ardennes in 1944?
Well, it was colder, I thought, but being that you're outside all the time, it was much colder.
Did you deal with any frozen toes or fingers or anything?
No, a lot of other guys did, yeah.
How did you avoid it?
I don't know. Fate.
Well, and you mentioned that your first combat was December 13th in the Hurkin Forest. This is just a few days before the Battle of the Bulge officially begins. But you've never been in combat before. What was that like? What was the first impression?
When we hit the forest and heard the guns firing at us, I cried. You think you're a big deal when you're 18. In real life, you're a big deal. Ma, what do you know? In combat, you're nothing but a baby. And I don't even... not afraid to admit I cried. Ma, where are you? You know? And I think mothers had the toughest job of all. They're sitting home not knowing where their sons are, if they're alive or dead. What that must have been for mothers to go through. That'll be terrible.
You're giving us some real powerful perspective here on what it was really like. And if there's anything you're not comfortable talking about, don't feel pressured. But when you say that, you know, that first night you cried, what was it that made you cry? What were you seeing or hearing or facing that brought you to that point?
People shooting at you, bombs dropping, and you're just afraid. But after that, you get over it. You're always afraid. If you're not afraid, you're going to die, you know, because then you become careless.
And, you know, most people listening have never operated a 60-millimeter mortar before. Can you walk us through in real, you know, basic terms how you did your job, what you had to do or consider or, you know, go through?
Well, in the mortar squad, you had the leader, the second in command, which they operated the mortar. And then you had three ammo bearers. The mortar came apart, the base plate came apart, but you never took it apart. You carried it that way. So the riflemen were right with us. They were right in front of us. You set the mortar down. You had to adjust the how far you wanted to go, and you had to be careful not to hit your own men. And once it was set up, the sergeant would see where it was going and tell you, come back a little, and different angles. And the second gunner would, he's the one that would pull the charges off the ammo and drop them in.
And so where were you as part of that equation?
Well, I was either the gunner or the second gunner most of the time. But you had to carry it, I mean, because it was only... that tall. I mean, it still weighed, but you had to carry it so you can drop it right away.
And how long did it take you to figure out that being near that mortar made you a target?
Well, you didn't have to figure too long because even in the forest, you're getting hit with all these shells and they explode in the trees and the shrapnel comes down. You had no place to hide.
Well, yeah, and that's one thing that I've always tried to imagine myself when I talk to guys who went through that like you did. You know, what do you do in a situation like that? You're kind of helpless, right? There's no controlling where a shell's going to hit a tree and stuff goes everywhere. These tree bursts killed a lot of people. So what, if that was happening, if incoming artillery or mortars are coming in, what do you do?
Well, you try to get covered as best you can. You hit the ground. But I think a lot of it is fate. On my 19th birthday, I never thought I'd see 20. They had us pinned down in this forest, and there was a big open field between us and the Germans. You couldn't get across that field. Finally, after the order came, march and fire. So everybody had to get up, go across that field, and when we did, the machine guns were firing at us, the 88s from the tanks, the mortars, everything. I dove into a crater. My feet were sticking out, and I prayed. I never thought I'd see 20, but evidently I got through it. I don't know how, but I think it's just fate. God was looking out for us.
Yeah, and where was that?
Well, we were trying to take the Schmanuel Dam, which was in, I forget, Schmidt was the name of the town, because they were set to blow the dam, and a lot of people would have got drowned. So we got through it. We finally took the town and saved the dam. I don't know how, you know.
Yeah, and so this is your 19th birthday, February of 45. And if you were back in the States, your mom and your sisters, your family would be celebrating with you. Instead, you're getting that command, march and fire. So how do you process that? Because you know what's out there, right?
I know. You don't. You can't think about that. You know, you just get up and go and hope that you don't get hit.
And by that time, you'd been through a lot, too. And I know we're kind of bouncing back and forth here chronologically. But, you know, during December, the Hürtgen Forest and the Battle of the Bulge and where you guys were going, I've talked to a lot of guys who've mentioned how cold it was and all that. And you said you're sleeping outdoors. But as those days pile up, and these are your first days of combat, did it feel like it was lasting forever? Was it going by quickly? What was it like to be in the middle of that?
Seems like it was never going to end, but you just went day by day, hoping you didn't get hit. I had another close call. Our outfit was the first foot troops to cross the Rhine River at Remagen. What happened, the 9th Armored Division happened to get there, not thinking there would be any bridges left, and the Ludendorff Bridge was still intact, which was a railroad bridge. So once they found that, 78th was close by, so the command called the 78th to get up there quick. So they trucked us up there. We went across the 9th Armored Division with the tanks. We were right behind them. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and they failed to blow that bridge. I don't know if it was because they got drunk or what. But once we got across, they tried everything. And when it got daylight, they were sending planes over. But after that day, that night, we took another town. And it got dark, and then Sarge says, well, we have to set up a front line there. But one of you guys could go down and see if you could find a bed in town and sleep. The other stays on the front line. So I flipped the coin with my buddy. I lost. So he was able to go down, find a bed. I stayed on the front line all night. And in the morning, I'm waiting for him to come up. I said, Sarge, where's Wheeler? He's supposed to come up. He got killed on the way down. He won the toss and lost his life. To me, that's fate.
I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You know, and you're an 18-year-old kid, yeah, Halfway around the world from your family. And then, of course, right in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge, here comes Christmas. Do you remember that Christmas, 1944?
Yep. We were holed up in a cellar of an old house. That German laying in the driveway. We had to go on the front line. We had 2 hours on and 2 hours off. I remember sitting in that cellar playing the harmonica, playing Christmas carols. Don't ask me when I had the harmonica, because I was used to play it, but I must have brought it with me and kept it. And that Christmas, that's what I did. The 2 hours we were off.
Were any of the other guys joining in?
Well, they were singing, yeah.
So you're playing the harmonica, and they're singing along with you Christmas carols.
Yeah.
With a dead German in the driveway.
Right. We didn't get any gifts.
Again, if there's nothing there, I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head, but I'm just wondering if there's ever a time since then when Christmas rolls around. Do you think back to that Christmas?
Oh, yeah. All the time. I think back to that 19th birthday, too. How I got to be 96, I don't know. You know, 18. I look at my great-grandson when he was 18, and I'm saying he couldn't possibly have been drafted. He looks like such a little kid. Were we like that? So 18, you're so young, and I think it's too early to go into having guys fight.
Yeah, and you were confronted with that all around you, guys just like you getting killed. You told us about a couple close calls, and you just mentioned your 19th birthday again, and you told me something there, that when you dove into that crater and your feet are sticking up, that you prayed. What do you pray in a moment like that?
You pray that you can get out alive. It's about all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So evidently you heard me.
Evidently so, but you still had a long way to go after that. And you made reference to the Bronze Star, that when the letter from the War Department went to your home back here in Connecticut, your mother was afraid to open it, thinking it was bad news, but it was actually saying, no, your son did something really courageous and special that earned him the Bronze Star. What can you tell us about that incident and why you were awarded the Bronze Star?
I really don't know. I guess they have to give Bronze Stars to somebody, so they try to pick out who.
Yeah, I've heard that line before, but I think your group of soldiers was in a situation where the Germans were on both sides of you, right?
Yeah.
So what really happened? You're not bragging. You're just helping us understand what you went through.
Well, I don't know. We just could see the Germans on our left side. They're going around the side, but I didn't think they'd get behind us. But evidently, Sergeant said they were behind us, so we automatically turned toward the rear, started dropping shells. Evidently, it helped. But the machine gunners were trying to get up the hill and go over the hill to take the objective, which I don't know what it was at the time. Because you don't know what's going on. I mean, they're telling you, well, we got to go here or there.
But if you hadn't done that, if your mortar shells hadn't been able to repel the Germans on that side, then a whole lot of people could have lost their lives.
Yeah, it would have been bad if they got behind us, yeah.
Is there something that you look back on and you say, well, that was the most challenging, most difficult aspect of what you were doing in the war?
Well, I think that marching fire was the worst.
Because they're basically saying, hey, go take your chance. There's nothing to help you.
If you can picture a couple of football fields, now you got to go from one end to the other. There's not a tree or nothing in between. With somebody shooting at you and dropping bombs on you, what it's like. I mean, you ran and you zigzagged, but even so, I don't know.
And if I'm wrong, correct me, but I'm just imagining that as you do that, you're seeing or becoming aware of other guys around you that are getting hit, right?
Oh, yeah, but you just keep going, you know.
And I've heard a lot of different perspectives on this. When it comes to casualties, guys you've served with getting hit, is that something that you found a way to deal with over time? Did it get a little easier to handle or process?
Well, I guess it was part of the deal. Naturally, you didn't like to lose anybody, but you're just glad it's not you.
And you gave us a hint of, you know, the significance of your regiment. The 310th was the first regiment to cross the Rhine River on foot at the Ludendorff Bridge in Remagen. You probably didn't know at the time how significant that would be or that people were still talking about it. But at 4 a.m, I'm guessing that's pretty dark, right? What was it like crossing that bridge?
It was bad because there was holes in the bridge. It was a railroad bridge, hoping you didn't fall through. They made a movie on that. But I saw that movie, but I said they weren't there because it showed when the guys were across the bridge. It was daylight and civilians were all clapping and everything. There were no civilians there, and it was dark, so the movie showed civilians clapping and everything.
And the point about it being dark and holes in the bridge, it's not like you can put a light on it, right? Because then you're telling the enemy, hey, here I am.
Yeah. No.
So that sounds like that was a little nerve-wracking.
And it took them a few days to knock that bridge down. They had the airplane coming over, and I think it was a few days before they finally got it down. But by that time, the combat engineers had pontoon bridges across.
So if you ever watched that 1969 film, The Bridge at Remagen, starring Robert Vaughn, remember that the filmmakers took a few pretty substantial liberties. And now you know what it was really like from one of the guys who crossed that bridge at 4 a.m. 77 years ago. It's time for our final break, but we'll have more with 96-year-old Frank Gallo of New Canaan, Connecticut. Don't forget to go online for photos and video with Frank. You'll even see the picture that he blows a kiss to every morning when he walks out of his bedroom, a wedding photo of Frank and Viola. You'll find all of that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.